This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, it's the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West here on RN and the ABC Listen app, and welcoming you to the 2023 season. Phone tapping in the Vatican, a papacy on the edge of collapse? Really? That is coming up. Australian Sikhs, along with millions of Sikhs around the world, will vote this Friday in a referendum to establish a separate state in India. Sikhs have faced discrimination, especially with the growth of Hindu nationalism. But religious and ethnic separatism is controversial even in the Sikh diaspora. Amar Singh is an Australian Sikh leader. He's also the founder of the charity Turbans for Australia and the 2023 New South Wales local hero. And I began by asking him about this honour.
It was a simple thing to give back to the community because as a migrant, when I first turned up here as a young 15-year-old person, I didn't have much of a grounding, didn't have any belonging. So once I established myself in life and then realized that there are issues we need to address in the society that religious communities and ethnic communities face in general, and one way to give back was through charity, to say, hey, we are part of the community, we are part of the society, and we want to help where we can. And that sort of grew really big since the bushfires. I didn't anticipate it to be this big. So it's been a huge shock and a surprise to me in a good way.
Yeah, and what sort of communities do you serve?
We serve anyone and everyone. So it's right across from metropolitan areas to regional communities during disasters and ongoing issues such as flood relief or disasters and also pandemic support.
How much did your experience, Amar, of some racial discrimination during your early years in Australia influence your decision to do this big community outreach?
The option was simple. It's either you sit back and go, what can I do? Or actually get up and do something. Like I said before, I didn't expect it to be this big. We started on a very small scale and now it's got to where it got to. So it was just a way to give back, to say we want to help our fellow Australians and fellow human beings in times of disaster and need. And that's how it started.
Now, you place a great deal of emphasis on harmony, not just rhetoric, but in what you do in encouraging community harmony. I wonder if it's not a bit controversial, though, Amar, that you have decided to support a referendum on the 29th of January. It's part of a worldwide referendum, we should say, to establish a Sikh state, Khalistan. I mean, is that something that you think in the back of your mind could disrupt a bit of harmony in Australia?
Any group or religious group or ethnics practicing their democratic right to establish a home for themselves, which if you look at back in the history, was promised to them, doesn't or should not interfere with harmony. And from my stand is neutral on Khalistan, I do support the Sikh self-determination in terms of saving their national resources, saving their water, saving their language and culture as well in India. The issue is not just about having a political power, but it's also about saving and preserving your culture, your language, which is constantly being eroded.
Would a state of Khalistan, in your understanding, be a state within India, or would it be a sovereign country? Would it be a Sikh country?
That's the idea behind it. The Sikh state would be a sovereign and independent country of its own right, and that's what many in the community are pushing for it. And I can say this, that there isn't 100% consensus on this. There are people that are against it. There are people who are neutral. There are people who don't think it's a good idea. But that's, again, for personal choice on the people to see what they believe in, what they believe in. But for what was promised to Sikhs back in the days of partition by the British of then India, it was a similar country to what Pakistan got for Muslims.
We know that the Sikh community, especially in 1984, after the assassination of Indira Gandhi by two bodyguards who were Sikhs, we know the Sikh community suffered a terrible backlash, thousands of people killed in pogroms against the Sikh community. Do you think the Australian government and the Western governments generally have been attuned to the plight of Sikhs in India, because they do have to deal on a very pragmatic level with the Indian government.
They do have to deal with the Indian government overall, but then also for smaller minorities to have their rights, because the issue is not just for Sikhs. The issue is for Jains and Buddhists and Christians and other minorities as well within India that are asking for self-determination and a separate state and their own rights. In Maharashtra, where there's a huge push for their own language, and it's been there for years and years. Because in India, it's not just one national language, one food, one culture. If you go from where we are up northern part of India, Punjab, to down to south to Kerala and Tamil Nadu, the food, the culture, everything changes.
Mm. I wonder, though, whether for someone like yourself who was dedicated to harmony, the idea of sovereignty based just purely on ethnicity or language or culture, is it in the end a good idea? I mean, shouldn't the task be to make a much more pluralist India rather than separatism?
They haven't done that in the last 70-something years that India has been independent. Then there wouldn't be a push for it. Because the problem is, if you look at it, people are still being persecuted in India for their religious beliefs, for their political beliefs. Sikh prisoners back from the 80s who've done their sentences, who finished their sentences, they're still not being released either. So there's a lot of issues. And I do understand what you're trying to say is, wouldn't it be better in unity to have a united country? But the country in its overall power has to respect individuals' rights and their beliefs as well.
Just finally coming back to this great honour that you and your organisation, Turbans for Australia, have received, what's the next phase? Are you going to expand?
We definitely are expanding. We've already got a food van running in Brisbane. We've got another relief centre set up in Thomastown, Victoria. So we're looking to expand again into Brisbane with another relief centre and then maybe into Canberra as well. So the idea is to grow, because this is a platform where young people, new migrants, can have an opportunity to work alongside others and to be productive for the society. So also the culture of giving back, but also taking ownership of this country, which is our own now, to call it a home and get involved in the local issues.
Very good to speak with you, Amar Singh. He's the founder of Turbans for Australia, which is a social service network started by the Sikh community. It now runs extensively around New South Wales. And Amar is the New South Wales local hero. And you can hear his Australia Day lecture here on RN. Amar, thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you, Andrew. Much appreciated for your time. Thank you.
A conservative Italian journalist has revealed that the late Australian Cardinal George Pell was the author of a searing critique of Pope Francis. Writing under a pseudonym, Pell claimed the papacy was a disaster and a catastrophe. He said a split in the church was coming, he called one of the Pope's allies a heretic, and even claimed the Vatican was running a phone-tapping operation. But what's motivated these claims? Dr. Austin Ivory is a fellow at Campion Hall at Oxford University and author of two landmark biographies of Francis, The Great Reformer and The Wounded Shepherd.
It was a long, kind of fairly rambling, very wide-ranging memo, which came out last year under the pseudonym Demos. And it was really divided into two parts. One was called The Vatican Today. Second part was called The Next Conclave. And the first part was really a whole series of complaints about the way things are being run in the Vatican, and particularly finances, which was of course, Pell's great speciality, but also, you know, lack of respect for the law. It was a sort of fairly devastating critique about the Vatican. And then the next conclave was an attempt to spell out a vision for the papacy. So Pell was clearly positioning himself. He believed that the end of the Francis pontificate would be coming soon. And he was spelling out what, in his view, the next pope needs to do, which, of course, was almost in every respect the opposite of what Francis has been doing. So it was all about kind of preaching with clarity, you know, dealing with the confusion asserting traditional morality, if you like, the agenda of the kind of the moralists among the cardinals and in the church, who believe that the church needs to be convincing, compelling and clear in everything it says. And it's about, we've got the truth and we need to preach it clearly. In other words, trying to reverse what they see as Francis's sort of lack of clarity or muddying of the waters in his attempt to have a more dialogical relationship with the world.
Pope Francis made it very clear that he believed in George Pell's innocence when George Pell was facing those charges. The Vatican said that George Pell was entitled to pursue all the legal avenues he could to gain his acquittal. So why such a personal critique?
Well, Francis has always been incredibly supportive of Pell, from the moment when he supported him, when he appointed him as the chief reformer of the Vatican finances. And then, as you say, when Pell was accused, Francis really stood by him, said he had to go back and face the music of civil justice, but believed in his innocence and so on. And so Francis has always been very supportive of Pell. And actually, Pell personally, whenever I spoke to Pell about Francis, Pell gave Francis a lot of credit for the reform on the finances. But you see, we're dealing here with essentially a political religious agenda. And what Pell represented in terms of his vision of the church and his vision of what the Pope is and papacy and so on was so starkly different from Francis. And Pell saw himself, he had become convinced that he was the man entrusted with the task of rescuing the church, you know, and as it were, having a more kind of John Paul II type of papacy. So my view of this is that Pell, and he did it, by the way, anonymously, I think partly as a way of increasing excitement over this, but he was convinced, I think, that the end of the pontificate was coming, and he saw himself, if not as the next pope, as the kingmaker for the conservative view of the church within the forthcoming conclave. So it was, if you like, a political move and a very political manifesto.
Can I ask you, Austin, because not only are you the author of the landmark book, The Great Reformer, about Pope Francis, you wrote a book with Pope Francis. We spoke to you about it a couple of years ago, Let Us Dream. You know this Pope very well. Is this pontificate about to end?
No. And I think this is where Pell has badly misjudged things. And I think, you know, Pell, as a political operator, frankly, has always been very clumsy. I always remember back in the 2015 Synod, he got together in a letter again, you know, with sort of lots of signatories and so on, and leaked it to the press. He did this kind of thing. He was a machine politician. And I think what happened almost inevitably whenever Pell did these things was it produced a very strong reaction in the church and among his fellow cardinals that this is an unecclesial. This is not the way you go about things in the church. If you have a problem and you're a cardinal, you can go and speak to the Pope anytime. Or if you want to lay out your views, you know, in an article or an interview, you're free to do that. But you do it in a way that's propositional, that's positive and so on. Pell's aggression towards Francis, towards this pontificate, I think has really tarnished his legacy. I mean, it left a very, very bad feeling. Not only the revelation that he was the author of this anonymous memo, but he also penned an article which was published immediately after his death with a critique of the current synod, which is this global consultation of the Catholic faithful, one of the most important things that's happening in this pontificate. And he, you know, he blasted it as sort of neo-Marxist and New Age and so on, in a way that really revealed his profound ignorance of the whole thing. I think it reflected badly on him.
If you think of the big moral issues, this Pope is pro-life from conception to natural death. He believes that children should have natural parents. He believes in the biological definitions of a man and a woman. He certainly altered the tone, but not the teaching on sexuality. So what is the complaint about from the conservatives?
Yeah, I mean, this is a key question. So often when the church is reported on, it's reported on as a battle between sort of progressives and conservatives, as if there are profound disagreements about doctrine and about ideas. Actually, Catholic teaching, more or less, people agree on, and Francis is a traditional Catholic in every respect. What really, really annoys, I think, a certain conservative about Francis' pontificate is that he is putting the proclamation of God's love and mercy first. So that the first thing people should hear and feel and see in the church is that mercy and that love, that unconditional embrace and that acceptance. Because Francis and many of those who think like him say, actually, the church can no longer use this kind of moralistic you know, we have the truth and moral discipline type of attitude in an age, above all, when the church, of course, lacks so much credibility on that score because of its own scandals. So this is about how you evangelize. And Francis is convinced that when people see that, when people see the way that, you know, Christians care for the environment, care for migrants, treat each other, the love and respect, that that makes the gospel deeply attractive. They start to ask, well, what's going on in the gospel? And then you allow and you give people the space to change. Whereas I think for Pell and for so many of the conservatives around him, who I think are a minority, but they're very vociferous, you know, they hearken back to an age when the church was the moral policeman, the source of truth, you know, the teacher. And so I think it's about that. I think it's about the model of church and the way the church engages in the world. This is the heart of the difference between what I would call the pastoral approach of Francis and the moralistic approach of Pell and others who think like him.
There was a fascinating detail, or let us say a fascinating allegation, in this critique of which George Pell was the anonymous author, and that is, he does say that telephone tapping is widespread in the Vatican. You know the Vatican very well. Does that seem likely, phone tapping?
Yeah, I mean, look, all sorts of stuff has been going on. This is all long predates Francis in terms of, you know, what goes on in the Vatican and some of the sort of shenanigans and the financial scandals. And there has been a big attempt to clean all that up, which has in turn led to accusations of people of supervision and vigilance, which is inappropriate. So yes, phone tapping, if you like. So I think Pell is throwing out stuff there, which is fairly well known, but he's doing it in a totally scattered way. And I think part of Pell's resentment also about the finances was that, you know, he had to go back to Australia to face these charges. And the financial reform by then, frankly, had stalled. It was not going well because Pell had put everybody's backs up in Rome. He was a good man to initiate the process, you know, an Anglo-Saxon scourer, if you like, to bring in at the beginning. But actually, to carry that reform through, needed a much more comprehensive, if you like, diplomatic approach. So I think when he came back to Rome feeling vindicated after his release from prison, and of course surrounded by people who said to him, you know, you're a martyr, I think it went to his head, frankly. And I think he failed to actually to embrace the possibility of prison, which was to, you know, as it were, do a little bit of work on himself inside. So I think the arrogance was there in an even greater way when he came out of prison. And that's why, looking back on Pell, I liked him, by the way, and he was always very good to me. And he's, you know, he's a nice man in so many ways. But I feel a bit of sadness. I think there was an opportunity there for Pell in his last years to have been really a great help to the church. And I think actually what he did was stir up unnecessary antagonism.
Even though, as we have emphasized, Pope Francis has not changed any doctrine, is he too accommodating of difference, as his critics would charge? Because the Pell critique says that some pontifical academies have invited speakers who are pro-abortion. I don't know that they've been invited to speak about abortion, but among their many views, they're pro-abortion.
Well, this is the problem, isn't it? That there's a certain purist view that sort of anybody who's invited by the Vatican must completely assent to Catholic doctrine on everything. Well, you know, if that were the case, you would never have dialogue with people who have important things to say to the church as well as with the church. So bridge building and dialogue involves necessarily inviting people who may not agree on everything with you. Isn't that the point of dialogue? And of course, the critique of Pell and other conservatives is you might get a woman like, you know, Marina Mazzucato, a great economist, being invited to be an advisor to one of the organizations in Rome, who, yes, no doubt, like many people, believes that abortion should be legal, but has a amazingly wonderful critique of contemporary capitalism, which is very much up the street of the church. Conservatives say, why is she allowed? But they don't have any problem, for example, with inviting pro-life people who may be climate change deniers, which is equally incompatible with church teaching. So this reveals a particular agenda and a particular concern. But again, the Vatican has always invited people, not just to advise it, but also as dialogue partners who don't agree with it and everything. And that's important.
Just as we wind up, Austin, back in 2018, I think it was 2017, 2018, there was a political hit job on Francis. I think a very controversial pro-Donald Trump Archbishop, Archbishop Vigano, was at the centre. He used a scandal involving the now defrocked Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, who was defrocked for sexual misbehaviour. He used that as a sort of foil against the Pope. It was an attempt to unseat the Pope. He called explicitly for the Pope to resign. Are we seeing a rerun of that, different characters, but the same objective, to get this Pope to quit?
Oh, I think unquestionably. I mean, there's a lot of knife sharpening going on in advance of the expectation of a conclave, whenever that may happen, either because Francis would die or because he would stand down because of ill health. And I think what happened last year was that when Francis was suffering quite badly physically, I think a lot of people sort of said, okay, you know, it's going to happen soon, hence the Pell memo. And now we're getting various books and so on coming out about now. And yes, there's a concerted move to have a very different kind of Pope in the future. Lots of them end badly. I mean, Vigano ended up believing all these anti-vax theories and MAGA Trump stuff and ultimately became a figure of fun. And I think actually a lot of these critics who they blast out, but then where does it go? And I think we're going to see that over the next year. We're going to see a lot of people laying out another vision of the church to replace Pope Francis's, but I don't think it will come to anything. I think everybody will have their say and then it'll peter out, because I think what Francis is doing is right there in the mainstream of the church, where the church needs to be, is what Francis is seeking to bring about through methods, particularly through the synod, that are patient, that are dialogical, that are open to the spirit, that are prayerful, that try and avoid, if you like, these kind of polarizing polemics. And I think in the long term, that's what will win out.
Dr. Austin Ivory, he is a senior fellow at Campion Hall at Oxford University. He's the author of the landmark book about Pope Francis, the Great Reformer. His most recent book written with Pope Francis is Let Us Dream. Thank you very much for coming back to the program, Austin.
Great to be with you, Andrew. Thank you.
So if Francis is facing another round of destabilization from his right, how likely is the church to survive? In an essay for The Atlantic magazine, Paul Eli of Georgetown University says the church will have to reinvent itself with a major shift in geography and thinking.
The church struggled to accommodate itself to the Roman Empire in the 5th century. It struggled to adapt to the sack of Rome shortly after that. It had to adapt to the rise of Islam early in the second millennium. It adapted to the emergence of the modern city-state in the middle of the second millennium, then to the modern age of technology and the Industrial Revolution in the early 19th century, and then to a similar revolution in travel and communications in the 20th century. To each of these, the Catholic Church has had to adapt and has done so with varying degrees of success.
I mean, how would you describe its latest attempts to adapt?
I think it depends on where you look. I mentioned in the article that the effort of framing the way the church encounters the times we live in has fallen to the popes. The popes are more prominent than any time in previous history because of communications, because of travel. Pope John Paul made 150 trips. Pope Francis has made several dozen. More people have seen them in person and through photographs and video than just about any other figures in human history. So this means that to a significant degree, they're the face of the church's encounter with the world of our time. And the three popes that have been significant in my lifetime have done it in three different ways. John Paul, of course, is a very long pontificate, but he presented the church as articulating a culture of life against a culture of death that he associated with secular society. Pope Benedict articulated the church representing a beacon or bulwark of the objective truth against the supposed relativism of the surrounding culture. Pope Francis has tried to present the church as presenting or keeping hold on the human scale and face-to-face human encounter in a world of big data and abstract encounters via technology. So we'd have to judge each of those and see how each of them has worked out. My own history and temperament make me most supportive of the pontificate of Pope Francis.
Yes, and of course the critique, though, Paul, is that in many ways Pope Francis has given up on the Catholic Church, that he's yielded to, you know, contemporary politics, contemporary sentiment. Is there anything in that?
To the extent that any pope, any leader, works with the situation of his or her age, he is open to the charges of accommodationism. So Pope Francis has sought to meet people where they are on many issues, including moral issues that are matters of great conflict within the life of the church. At the same time, he's opposed what he calls the throwaway culture of modern society, the culture of indifference, the culture of waste, the culture of environmental degradation, the culture that thrives on huge gaps between the haves and the have-nots. And all these things, he's been stronger than any recent pope. And so it's simplistic to suggest that he suddenly ceased to oppose the world and that his predecessors somehow kept up the opposition and fought the good fight.
When we speak of his predecessor, Benedict XVI, reading a lot of pieces after he died, a lot of writers tried to emphasize that he was a man of the West. He was on a quest to reignite Catholicism in the West, especially Europe, which he saw as its heartland. Certainly not its birthplace, but maybe its heartland. But did that ultimately become a lost cause?
Certainly, Benedict was a man of the West, and as Cardinal Ratzinger, he was probably more fluent in the tradition of Western Christianity than anybody. And I use that term fluent rather than brilliant, because I think it had to do with it being a kind of language that he spoke. If you were judging by statistics, you'd have to say that the church is not any stronger in Europe than it was prior to Benedict's pontificate. But the church and Catholics don't go by statistics. I think he made an important contribution to reminding us of what's robust in Western Christianity, but at the same time, he had a blind spot or even a defensiveness about the aspects of Christianity and other cultures that are equally strong and fruitful.
I mean, where were those blind spots, Paul?
For the Atlantic, I touched on to a certain degree, and then also in some writing I've done for the New Yorker. Pope Francis has been quite vigorous in his wish to encounter people of other faiths. And in that, he follows on a strong precedent set by Pope John Paul. Pope Benedict, in contradiction or in distinct from both of them, was quite leery of the encounters with people of other faiths. In 2000, before he was pope, he wrote a document called Dominus Jesus, which used pretty harsh language to suggest that not only is Christ the savior in the Catholic and Christian tradition, but to go on to say that not only other religions, but other Christian bodies are in a gravely deficient situation when it comes to the whole question of salvation. Now, those are harsh terms, and they, to me, suggest a blind spot vis-a-vis the church's encounter with other Christian bodies and other religions, one that I think Pope Francis has really tried to correct.
This raises a fascinating point that you dwell on in your article. If there is a reinvention of the Catholic Church, it's very much to do with geography. So where is geography influencing, even dominating this reinvention?
We'll know better in 25 years than we do now, but it can't be insignificant that the majority of the world's Catholics now live in the global South. It can't be insignificant that beginning with Pope John Paul, even beginning before him, with Paul VI to a certain degree, the Vatican has recognized this by appointing bishops and cardinals from outside of Europe and from places all over the world. And it can't be insignificant that for the middle class, at least, travel to other places is easier than it was before. Communication among places is easier than it was before. So, like it or not, we live in a society that can't be defined by Western culture in the way that it was, let's say, for 500 years from the Renaissance up until Vatican II.
So, yes, the global South is the new center of Catholic growth. That in itself, though, has brought for this Pope some problems. Where has he encountered, for example, some pushback against his accommodation of local customs, especially, for example, in Latin America, his homeland?
Pope Francis comes from Argentina. He's a pope of the global South. He spent 70 years there and most of his life as a Catholic leader there. He's no stranger to Rome. He's no stranger to Western culture, but he's had to see with both eyes for most of his life. And I would say that's the situation for more and more of us. He initiated a synod on the Amazon that brought many people from the Americas to Rome and brought a whole diversity of religious expression within Catholicism to Rome. That was a flashpoint for people who don't like a certain kind of costume, don't like a certain kind of mass, don't like the prospect of deacons enjoying the role of ordained priests. All these things were flashpoints for him, and they're not yet settled, and they're not going to be settled simply anytime soon.
In spite of its own grievous failings, you do make the case that the church's idea of human rights and human dignity has in fact become commonplace in the West. In what way? And indeed, in Western law, in what way?
I'm not an expert in constitutional law and in the way that it shapes public policy, but as I understand it, we in the West take for granted the inherent value of every life, the inherent equality of all people, and all sorts of rights that extend from that. Now, the extent of those rights and the nature of them is up for debate, and that's the stuff of our common life. But that we're all on some level created equal, and that rights and responsibilities follow from that, Catholic Church contends, derives from a Judeo-Christian view of the world in which those rights belong to us because we are endowed with them by our Creator. Long story short, that narrative, worked out very carefully by the French philosopher Jacques Maritain, became a basis and a significant one for the UN's Universal Declaration on Human Rights of 1948. And much of what we've seen in international law since then has played out on that basis.
Paul Eli of Georgetown University and his essay in The Atlantic also reviews John McGreevy's new book, Catholicism, A Global History, From the French Revolution to Pope Francis. And that's it for today. Thanks to Hong Jiang and Beth Stewart. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.